Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, February 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And consider the difference a year makes. A year ago, the CPAC Conservative Political Action Conference was all about how to stop Donald Trump. This year, he's the guest of honor as President of the United States.
You know, my first major speech was at CPAC, and probably 5 or 6 years ago, first major political speech, and you were there. And it was, I loved it. I loved the people. I loved the commotion. And then they did these polls where I went through the roof and I wasn't even running, right? But it gave me an idea.
On the other hand, and on another spoke of the Beltway around Washington, D.C., there's an election going on for chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Heard of them? Unlike last year, there is no confident, unified, flag-waving team of donkeys led by Debbie Wasserman Schultz. No. Schultz first got outed by Russian hackers, apparently, and then discredited by the Bernie Sanders campaign. Now, where are the Democratic leaders of tomorrow? That's the humble question posed at the DNC this year, where DNC might just stand for damage control.
We need an organizer leading the DNC.
I spent the bulk of my career working on police reform.
We need to be spending more time in rural America. We need to be spending more time in our communities of color where we can lift people up and get them involved in the process.
The Democratic Party has not done a good enough job of making young people and all people connected to this party.
Intersectionality. I'm a walking intersectionality. I'm a left-handed Maltese American Episcopalian gay war veteran. All right.
Seven declared candidates for DNC chair took to the stage on Wednesday night, underscoring the huge void in leadership. Between the noise of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer here in liberal New York on the East Coast and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on the liberal West Coast in California. What about all the voting American Democrats in between, especially those Democrats supposedly energized by 8 years of Barack Obama all over the country? What happened to Organizing for America, or OFA? Why wasn't it a force multiplier for the DNC, supposedly representing the newfound momentum and enthusiasm that elected Barack Obama? Howard Dean served as chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2005 to 2009. He served 6 terms as governor of Vermont and is a former presidential candidate as well. He's endorsed a long-shot candidate for winning the DNC chair position, Pete Buttigieg, a 35-year-old Harvard-educated Rhodes Scholar and veteran who is mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Howard Dean says it's time for out with the old, in with the new, and he means it quite literally.
The DNC is basically the organizational end of the party. It doesn't have a lot to do with policy. It does have a lot to do with how well things are organized. It's not a democracy, although we try to make it somewhat of a democracy. We should, because the Democratic Party is incredibly complicated. It's not sort of unicolored like the Republican Party. There's a lot of different kinds of people in the Democratic Party. So if you don't have somewhat of a democracy, then you really are ineffective in a party that's as diverse as we are. The chairman sets the agenda. The chairman is responsible for raising all the money. I mean, there are people who do that, the treasurer, the finance chair, the finance staff. But the chairman really is responsible for making sure that all the things that get done get done. And then more importantly, the chairman is pretty much the chief decider in how the money gets spent. And the money can't be spent on Congress and the Senate, which much of course that's what they want to do. But the money has to be spent outside the Beltway.
And where is the leadership in the DNC right now, in the Democratic Party right now?
Well, there's plenty of leadership in the Democratic Party in waiting. My generation is clogging up the works, but there's a ton of young, great leaders. The one is a bit of a long shot, is I'm backing for chair, is Pete Buttigieg, who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan, a Rhodes Scholar, 36 years old. That's the face of the new Democratic Party. Whether the old guys are willing to get out of the way yet or not, I'm not sure.
Should Pelosi go? Should Chuck Schumer go?
Yeah, I learned that my term in the DNC that I stay out of congressional politics. But there are a lot of good people in the House and the Senate who are going to be running for president, and I hope most of them are under 60.
Is it about the presidency? Isn't it about the state and local governments, particularly now the levels of organization in this democracy that have little to do with the federal government? Isn't it about packing those levels of government with candidates and possible leaders for the future? The Republicans are way ahead of the Democrats.
They are. They kicked our butts for the last 8 years. But on the other hand, we kicked their butts for the 4 years before that. So, yes, the answer is we've got a long way to go. We haven't focused as we should have on local politics at all, and we need to do that. And that means, look, Washington is like middle school on steroids. It's a completely different world than most of us live in, and they're ineffective.
What is the difference between Keith Ellison and Tom Perez, in your view?
They're both really good people. They're both inside the Beltway people who've been endorsed by all kinds of prominent senators and congressmen and so forth. Unfortunately, the election has been somewhat polarized, which is another reason I'm supporting Pete. So, I think that's problematic. I think what we don't need now is a rerun of the election that we just had. But look, I want the generation that fueled my campaign, fueled Bernie's campaign, and fueled Obama's campaigns to be in charge now. We're going to have to fundamentally change how we do campaigns in this country and fundamentally change how we think about government and fundamentally change the way we talk to each other. This new generation's got plenty of faults, just like every generation, but they're pragmatic. They're not ideological. They're interested in facts. They are willing to work together across lines. They're slightly more conservative than most Democrats about money, and they are completely with us on social justice issues. That seems to me that that's the generation we ought to put in the saddle to prepare ourselves. They're also going to be voting longer than any other age group. This is not just a 50-state strategy. It's a 50-year strategy. They're going to be voting for 50 years. I think their time is now, and I don't think we should put this off any longer.
But didn't the Obama campaign mobilize that group precisely in 2008? We have a clip here that I want to play from a New Republic article author, Mika Sifri, who talked about how the Obama campaign really created this whole leadership class and mobilized millennials and new generation. And here's what he said happened to it.
50,000 of the people who reply say they're interested in running for local or state office. This mass number of people who have been so activated by the success and the experience and the training that they have in community organizing, they want to keep going. Instead, what happens is the campaign people get together in Chicago and they basically decide, of course, this is going to be controlled by the DNC. We're going to call it Organizing for America instead of Obama for America, but they keep the same platform, the same, you know, it's still the same list, and it's all going to just sit inside the DNC. And now that, John, is where you start getting emails asking to buy coffee mugs and sign thank you notes supporting congressmen who have, you know, endorsed the president's agenda. But they never used it as a tool to pressure Democrats who are being obstructionist or Republicans who are being obstructionist. They never used it as a tool to support local candidates who wanted to run. And as a result, early in the Obama administration, this giant grassroots muscle starts to atrophy.
Did you allow a giant grassroots millennial political muscle to atrophy in the DNC?
Well, I wasn't there at the time. I had left the DNC after Obama won. I also think there's a few inaccuracies in there. OFA was actually organized outside the DNC, which is one of the reasons. Look, the DNC always atrophies when we have a president of our own party. Same thing happened under Bill Clinton. It becomes the reelect movement for the president. In this case, OFA actually drained revenues away from the DNC. The DNC is essentially run by the White House political director when you have an incumbent president. So I would disagree a little bit with Mika. I don't think that the DNC was the OFA may have been ostensibly housed in the DNC, but the DNC was essentially the leadership of the DNC was really coming out of the White House political office, which is what happens on the Republican side as well. I think there was a fundamental mistake, too, in the organizational capacity to think that you can mobilize people for a particular issue in the same way that you can mobilize them for a candidate is a big mistake. And I think that's the mistake they made. But you really cannot transfer the popularity of a particular individual to a series of issues. That you have to let people choose, and you cannot house that in the DNC. And it wasn't housed in the DNC.
Whether it's housed in the DNC.
They did that because they had a problem with fundraising. They couldn't figure out if they're going to fundraise into the DNC or into OFA. And as a result, they did both. And that hurt the DNC even more than it would have been hurt anyway by having an incumbent president.
But if there were 50,000 people who wanted to run for local office,
right,
and nothing was done with them, does that begin to explain why the Democrats have, the state control in just six states versus the Republicans?
That certainly does. What should have happened is they should have continued with the 50-state strategy and then turned all those folks over to the state and local parties and to re-energize the parties, which is what I did when I left and DFA was created. Our motto was, look, I didn't win, but go out and change the Democratic Party, and you can do one of three things. You can join the Democratic Party, or you can try a hostile takeover, which is actually what Bernie has done in some of the parties, in the state parties, or you can just set up your own organization. All three of them were done. As a result, Democracy for America exists today, 12 years after I ran and did not win. OFA, I think, is now we're going to try something different. If Pete wins, we will. What we really need to do is connect local activists with the state and, most importantly, local parties. This generation is doing it already. There's something called Swing Left, which already has a couple of 100,000 people signed up, tons of people signed up, including many, many women, to run for office locally. That is what has to happen. And I see a new DNC coming out of this if Pete wins, who's 36 years old. Look, this young generation doesn't like institutions because they're clunky, they're slow, and they're unnecessary in many ways. But they are necessary to expand the reach of people beyond their own life cycle, both politically and literally. That's what we have to do. We have to coordinate. We have to let these young folks who are now in their 30s, who started in my campaign 12 years ago when they were in their early 20s, we have to let them do this the way they want with some guidance and some coordination. And that's a fundamental change in the mission of the DNC, which is why I'm supporting Buttigieg.
What about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama? What do you do with them? I mean,
they could be incredibly helpful raising money for us. I mean,
right.
That's always, and they would be great doing that. But they're not going to direct the DNC. It's not going to work. This is an organization that has to come from the grassroots up, or we're going to fail as a party and the DNC will become irrelevant. And these organizations are going to happen anyway. Whether the DNC is going to be coordinating them and working with them is what's at stake here.
So when does he get back in? What does Trump have to do to get him really involved?
He's already in. I mean, look, he deserves a vacation. He deserves to get his life back together again after the most intense 8 years that any human being could spend. But the DNC's got to get itself together, and then we're going to work all that stuff out.
And you'll be involved?
It depends who wins.
Howard Dean, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Howard Dean was chairman of the Democratic National Committee from 2005 to 2009, a six-term governor of Vermont, and former presidential candidate.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website-building platform that helps businesses, entrepreneurs, and individuals to create websites, portfolios, online stores, and more. Learn more at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. New York Presbyterian, where two Ivy League medical schools combine in their commitment to teach, practice, and expand the frontiers of medicine. Amazing things are happening here. More at nyp.org/amazingadvances.
There are alternative facts, there are non-facts in this strange political environment, and then there are delayed facts, late facts, missed-the-deadline facts. Scott Pruitt was confirmed as the new administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency last Friday. The vote was accelerated, not because there was some critical piece of federal business that needed attention. It was to win a race against lawyers who were trying to get made public about 3,000 pages of Pruitt's emails from his time as Oklahoma Attorney General, supposedly showing his close ties to the fossil fuel industry. But the lawyers couldn't get them released until Wednesday, when over 6,000 pages of correspondence were finally made public in response to a lawsuit filed by the Center for Media and Democracy. Lisa Graves is the director for the Center for Media and Democracy. She joins me now. Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, John. It's nice to be on.
So why were these documents delayed for any reason?
Well, the Team Pruitt there in Oklahoma, where he was the attorney general of the state, basically dragged their feet for months and months. And then during his confirmation process, senators asked him about his relationship with these industries, with these oil companies and gas companies. And he basically said they should go file an open records request with his office and, in essence, get in line behind us after we've been waiting for more than 2 years for these materials. And so it's more stonewalling on his part because we know that these documents, some of which just came out this week, show his cozy ties with these big companies and how much he was willing to use the public office of attorney general to serve the private interests of these big corporations.
And that's essentially right. That, I mean, that is the issue here, that Pruitt as attorney general was acting as essentially a kind of counsel for the fossil fuel industry, not as a representative of the people of the state of Oklahoma. Here's Senator Jeff Merkley, who is making that point in the hearings on January 18th.
You used your office as a direct extension of an oil company rather than a direct extension of the interests of the public health of the people of Oklahoma. Do you acknowledge that you presented a private oil company's position rather than a position developed by the people of Oklahoma?
Senator, with respect, I disagree. The efforts that I took as Attorney General were representing the interest of the state of Oklahoma.
Lisa Graves, what in these documents disputes his answer and supports Merkley's question?
Well, these documents include additional references for Scott Pruitt to cut and paste from industry talking points as part of the legal positions and public positions that he was putting forward. And it also shows a number of communications with his staff, cozy communications with his staff and groups that are funded by the Koch brothers and others, talking about how, in essence, they're on the same team. And so, you know, this is a situation where now we have this man in charge of the EPA, and he has basically committed his public career, his public life, to trying to destroy that agency and limit its power to regulate the toxins, the toxins of mercury, to regulate carbon, to address the harms to our climate, and to engage in a variety of regulatory actions to protect us against the pollution of our water and our air. He's now in the cabinet, and they're still trying to stonewall us and stonewall the American people.
All right. Well, Lisa, I want to be careful here because, I mean, and it's no, you know, tongue in cheek. I mean, I've been called a member of the media, you know, enemy of the United States here. Let's be careful with the language. You say cozy communications. What is an example of a cozy communication or an inappropriate communication that you can see between Pruitt and the fossil fuel industry?
Well, in this instance, we see communications from them talking about these past letters that they've put together and how he should just cut and paste from those in order to move forward. Now, it's certainly the case that people do sometimes cut and paste, although I think in this instance where the New York Times talked about how he basically just slapped his letterhead on an energy company's critique of energy policy, that's a part of a pattern that he has, this cutting and pasting. And so at the same time, I would say to you that this this team of Pruitts in Oklahoma has continued to deny us access to any emails directly from Mr. Pruitt. And so we are in court this week and next week trying to get those materials and beyond, because they've only given us a tip of the iceberg of these materials. They're still hiding information. But what we do know is that this is a pattern, this close relationship. And in fact, he hasn't apologized for it. He's claimed that it is, in essence, representative government, that he's representing all the people of Oklahoma, including those oil companies and gas companies.
Anything in these documents that you've seen so far that would have denied him confirmation, number one? And number two, officials in Oklahoma that we've spoken to say that, you know, Pruitt has a view that the fossil fuel industry and environmentalists need to work more collaboratively together. And that's what he's committed to as head of the EPA. And he's not going to be just one versus the other. He's going to try to get them together around the same table. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I say that's an interesting talking point, since in his career, his actions speak louder than his words, and those actions have shown a tremendous hostility, perhaps the most hostile person ever nominated and confirmed to head the EPA. He has basically declared war on the EPA. That's his rhetoric about the EPA as a warrior against the EPA. Those aren't our words. Those are the words that he has used and that he and his colleagues have put forward, that's what he saw as his role. So if indeed he's going to somehow be the partner of the environmental community, that would be a major major change in course. I don't think it's going to happen based on his documented history, but I suppose we'll see, and we'll see more of his documents as the court orders more and more of them released.
But you don't believe anything you've seen so far would have changed the confirmation vote?
No, and in fact, given the makeup of Congress, we actually did end up with having one Republican senator vote against him. But the fact is that the Senate is entitled to this information, and if it were run properly, if it were run along with normal standards for nominees, a nominee would not have been allowed to stonewall and go forward. The Senate would have determined that it needed that information for the sake of all of its members to be educated versus ramming him through to be confirmed last week.
Lisa Graves is director of the Center for Media and Democracy. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you, John.
Drought in California? Don't tell that to the people of San Jose. Residents are asking why nobody saw the flooding coming. Record flooding swept 14,000 people into evacuation early this week. Weeks of rain meant that reservoirs are full, and less than 20% of California now faces drought conditions after years of dry weather. But the extreme weather is taking a toll on the state. Julia Protas-Sulik has been covering the floods and their aftermath for the San Jose Mercury News. Julia, give us an update. And my goodness, the change has been extraordinary.
It's quite a pendulum, John. I mean, we've been in 5 years of drought, and people have had buckets in their showers to collect water for all these years. And now all of a sudden, we have so much water, we don't know what to do with it. It's caused tremendous problems here in San Jose. Our Coyote Creek, which people didn't pay much attention to for years, all of a sudden overflowed right through San Jose, the heart of Silicon Valley.
Is this a 100-year flood that followed a 100-year drought? And is the government equally responsible for not seeing either one coming?
You know, I talked to fire captains and officials with San Jose, and they said they've been preparing all week in this multi-agencies getting together, planning for all this water that spilled over Anderson Dam, which is about 20 miles south of San Jose. But even with that, there was a lot of misdirection, and now there's finger pointing about why the river overflowed when it seemed like couldn't you see it coming, folks? So there's a lot of explaining to do here, for sure.
And in the middle of California, and especially Northern California, when things change, the extremes, I mean, the capacity for water in Northern California is absolutely extraordinary. And it's hard for any infrastructure, I would think, to be prepared for any possible flood.
Well, and we're certainly seeing the aging infrastructure that we have. I was up in Oroville last week when we thought that was the disaster zone. And you have a 50-year-old dam that was not up to standards. And people were so caught off guard that at noon, the day that people were told to flee, everyone was told, oh, no, everything's fine. And then 4 hours later, they get these emergency broadcast messages on their phones. I mean, I was talking to people, they got the messages at Walmart, some of them, and they left their grocery carts half full with their ice cream melting and didn't come back for days.
The drought is over. That's good news. But there are going to be lessons from this, or fears and worries from this event that are going to last for a long time. What are they?
Well, San Jose did learn about a decade ago when we had flooding from the Guadalupe River, which goes right through downtown, just not too far from Coyote Creek. And they did a huge project. And at first, the city was boasting about how well the Guadalupe Parkway project was working in the flood control. Now we're seeing that the little Coyote Creek is just as menacing. So people are starting to talk about big projects to help ensure this doesn't happen again there.
Julia Protas-Sulik has been covering the floods and their aftermath in Central California. She works for the San Jose Mercury News. Julia, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We have all kinds of technology to help preserve our movie memories these days. All of the nominated movies for the Oscars are either still playing or downloadable in advance of the awards on Sunday night.
The Let me ask you, if you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you gonna be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
I gotta maintain our boat now. I work on George's boat 2 days a week. I got two girlfriends, and I'm in a band. You're a janitor in Quincy. What the hell do you care where you live?
It's been a very good year for movies, and with everything downloadable and rentable on demand, we can rerun the Oscar contenders from years past. And some years, the best picture was a real dog, or wild dog, in the case of Dances with Wolves. Do you remember Dances with Wolves? It beat out Goodfellas, amazingly, which I'll bet you have probably watched a dozen times since it was released in 1990. Well, Mark Harris did this even deeper download for a year beloved in his movie memory, 1967. The Graduate, Bonnie and Clyde, In the Heat of the Night. And even though Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and Dr. Doolittle, the two other 1967 Best Picture nominees, look a bit vinegary today, all in all, it was a very good year. Author Harris wrote about those five films in his 2008 book Pictures at a Revolution, but on the 50th anniversary of all of them together, we wondered if we might eventually look back on this year as a Hollywood crossroads moment.
1967, of course, was a moment when the civil rights movement, when Vietnam, racial issues, women's issues were starting to be on the front burner. And, you know, you see in everything from the kind of nihilistic, chaotic violence in Bonnie and Clyde to the depiction of race relations in The Heat of the Night to the depiction of the generation gap in The Graduate, which is something that movies really hadn't tackled before. You see movies beginning to get an appetite to cover that kind of material.
And let's talk about the story of Bonnie and Clyde, because every decade when I revisit that movie, it gets more and more amazing.
This year's Miss Bonnie Parker.
Glad to meet you.
I'm Clyde Barrett.
Clyde.
We robbed banks.
But the story of how it got made is maybe even more bizarre than Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary because Bonnie and Clyde seems so much of its moment, but it was actually hatched 4 years earlier in 1963 by David Newman and Robert Benton, two writers at Esquire who were really influenced by French movies of the time, by François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard. So Bonnie and Clyde went through many, many kind of almost on its way to the screen. There was a moment when Truffaut was going to actually direct it, when Godard was going to direct it, when Bob Dylan and Shirley MacLaine might have ended up being the stars of it. And
wow.
And yet, you know, after 4 years, it finally comes to the screen with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, and it seemed in the middle of 1967 to have been hatched right out of that moment rather than to have been in the works for 4 years.
Let's talk about The Graduate, because The Graduate retains the qualities of Mike Nichols' just surprise and sense of comedy and Dustin Hoffman's sense of repressed sexuality. And that, again, holds up.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me.
Oh, yeah. And it's sort of hard to overstate the impact that The Graduate had. I mean, there wasn't much of an indie movement back in 1967, but The Graduate was an independent film. And it opened at the end of 67. It played in theaters continuously for 2 years. And by the time its run was over, it was the third highest grossing movie in history up to that time.
In the Heat of the Night won the Oscar for Best Picture. What did it mean then? And what do you think it's comparable to as we contemplate the Oscars for this year?
That win for In the Heat of the Night taps into a kind of longstanding Academy tradition, which is that the most daring movie, the most critically beloved movie, is rarely the one that wins.
What do they call you up there?
They call me Mr. Tibbs.
Mr. Tibbs! Well, Mr. Wood, take Mr. Tibbs, take him down to the depot, and I mean boy like now!
Usually the Academy is daring enough to nominate something like The Graduate or Bonnie and Clyde, but not quite forward-looking enough to give it Best Picture.
In 1967, the movie-going public was saying goodbye to the movie musical, and Dr. Doolittle was sort of the last example.
A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals.
How do you think Dr. Doolittle relates to La La Land, which is something that the movie-going public is saying hello to for the first time in a while?
The interesting thing about Dr. Doolittle is, it didn't do well. It was very expensive. It really was near the end of the kind of traditional Hollywood musical. Those musicals dragged on for a few more years. When I think of La La Land, I think of something more like Cabaret, which came along just 5 years after Dr. Doolittle, and really it seemed to point toward a new possibility for movie musicals, and yet it turned out to be a kind of one-of-a-kind movie. It didn't spark a whole trend in more modern, more daring movie musicals.
In terms of, the indie world that has transformed Hollywood, and, movies are coming from all different directions and places nowadays, what do the nominees for Best Picture say about the current moment in America right now and what we were too scared to even come close to back in 1967?
You never know whether an Oscar year, a lineup of Best Pictures, perfectly represents the year or not for a while. But I like this set of 9 nominees this year because you really have an extraordinary range of possibilities that show you that even traditional movies are changing. I mean, one of the most straight-up crowd-pleasers that's nominated this year and the highest-grossing movie of the 9 is Hidden Figures. And yet, it stars 3 African-American women, which is almost unprecedented for a mainstream Hollywood movie, let alone for one that it turns out to be the biggest hit in the Oscar lineup.
Mark Harris, author of Pictures at a Revolution and 5 Came Back, talking about 1967 and thinking about this year's Oscars. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you so much, John.
As we've mentioned, it's a grand study in movie-making contrast at this year's Oscars. All kinds of unique individual stories. 7 of the 20 acting nominees are people of color from films like Moonlight, Fences, and Lion. Suspense is everywhere, but particularly and surprisingly in the category of Best Original Song. La La Land's potential dominance extends here, of course, with nominations for 2 different songs. But Takeaway Culture reporter Melissa Locker says a split La La Land vote could make it anyone's game this year.
On one hand, you have Sting. And who can argue with Sting?
Who can argue with Sting?
But then...
And also the song that he's doing, right?
Right. Which is from the James Foley story, which, not that many people saw, but people are going to love.
Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking.
So don't despair of the empty chair. Somehow I'll be there.
But put that up against Moana.
Right. And Moana is actually pretty interesting because you have Lin-Manuel Miranda, and if he wins, he's going full EGOT. And he will be the youngest EGOT ever.
Remind us again what EGOT stands for.
That means he will have won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. And he actually will be a PGOT. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on public radio, but he will be a PGOT because he also won a Pulitzer.
See the light as it shines on the sea. It's blinding, but no one knows how deep it goes.
So the Moana song, did you like it?
I do. It's very catchy. It's very funny. I think, the most catchy song from all of this, though, is Justin Timberlake's Can't Stop the Feeling from Trolls. And it's basically like Pharrell's Happy, mm-hmm. but about trolls. And it's very catchy. It's definitely had the most like pop chart action out of all of them. But I don't know if the Oscar voters are going to be interested in rewarding Justin Timberlake or if they're going to be voting much more for like the film industry and their La La Land.
But again, look at this. I mean, you've got the talent of Sting, the talent of Lin-Manuel Miranda, and let's not forget Justin Timberlake, a huge, huge talent.
Right, and let's not forget Justin Hurwitz, who wrote the entire score and all the songs for La La Land. But the other thing I was thinking about is I was looking at these compared to some of the previous winners, Like, are any of these this year's It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp? What about Streets of Philadelphia? My Heart Will Go On? Yeah. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head? You know, if you look back at the history of the Oscar song winners, there are some pretty crazy winners out there.
That is true.
And it's honestly really hard to look at this field and see who could do it, because honestly, any of them could take it.
Although, in the case of La La Land, if it's got two songs, doesn't that split the vote and favor one of the other candidates?
Maybe. But I don't know if it's splitting the vote a big thing. Maybe this will be one of those years that it's an Oscar tie. There have been a lot of Oscar ties in the past, like six of them, I believe. So maybe this year's the year. There's going to be a tie between two La La Land songs.
That would only work if it's a tie between La La Land songs. But if they split the vote and Lin-Manuel Miranda wins because it gets more votes, I mean, having two songs nominated didn't do any favors to La La Land.
Right. And I think, you know, I wonder also if people are just going to be sort of have a little bit of Lin-Manuel Miranda fatigue. Like if they're just going to be like, well, maybe not this year. Because, I mean, I'm sure he's going to write a song for an Oscar winner in the future.
Exactly.
He can peacock later.
He can do anything that he wants. So let's relax into that La La Land moment.
Look in somebody's eyes to light up the skies, to open the world and send it really. A voice that says I'll be here and you'll be all right.
But I think you do also sort of have to look back and see who is performing the song. Because, I mean, as much as we love Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, they're not singers. Mm. And they're going against Sting and Justin Timberlake. And Justin Timberlake teamed up with Max Martin, who's like the biggest hit maker in the world. And no shade on Emma Stone at all, but she's no Justin Timberlake when it comes to singing. And I don't think she thinks she is.
Well, you've convinced me there's a huge amount of suspense here.
There is. It could go anyway. But I'm still going to go with none of these songs are as good as It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp.
Well stated. The genius and wisdom of Melissa Locker, What Would We Do Without It, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. It was an old bit of history that made national headlines after the 2012 killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida. Stand Your Ground, a doctrine of self-defense allowing armed citizens to confront intruders on their property, depending on reasonable expectations of threat. It can be traced back to colonial times. But what is considered reasonable varies in the almost half of U.S. states that have such laws. The notion of reasonable can be further adjusted by a jury in court. And that's at the heart of a hearing that's begun in Tampa this week. In Florida, the Stand Your Ground law allows people to use deadly force when they fear death or great bodily harm. But a police captain, Curtis Reeves, shot a citizen in a movie theater in 2014 and claims he was acting in self-defense. The hearing will determine if he stands trial for second-degree murder or if he's cleared. Harvard researcher Caroline Light says Stand Your Ground is the sometimes violent legal offspring of two even older doctrines— a duty to retreat, and a man's home is his castle, where you can shoot first and ask questions later. Caroline says, as firearms have proliferated, lawmakers are faced with the challenge of making rules for when gunfire breaks out between the most privileged people in the U.S. and the most vulnerable members of society. Caroline Light is director of undergraduate studies at the Harvard Program for Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Her new book is called Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Welcome, Caroline. And where did this term Stand Your Ground come from?
I would say probably 19th century is when courts started using that term. A man may stand his ground rather than retreat from a threat.
Always a man.
Usually a man, usually a white man, even though they didn't always explicitly state that. But Stand Your Ground is at odds with the ages-old duty to retreat. That was entrenched in English common law, from which United States law is derived. And the rule was that if you were threatened, you weren't allowed to fight back with lethal violence until you first tried to get away.
I mean, I remember in the mid-20th century that there were cases where people would come upon somebody's home and they would use a gun. And there was, the discussion was, first of all, whoa, why would you do such a thing? And, you know, an innocent person comes along on your property. You know, the fact that you would shoot them is outrageous. The
right.
expectation that anyone would have a gun at their front door was just a real fringe kind of scenario.
Right. Well, a lot of this has to do with the castle doctrine and the idea that the exception to the duty to retreat is that if you're in your house and you feel yourself to be threatened, then in many jurisdictions, you're allowed to shoot first, ask questions later, because it's your house. And your house is your castle. So in the United States, the castle doctrine, especially early republic through the 19th century, was very much about white men protecting their home and property.
How has that tracked parallel with the evolution of the way we view firearms and the expectation that people will actually be carrying firearms, whether they're at home or wandering around the streets?
I would say they're very much parallel. And it does seem when you look at it that it's somewhat ironic on one hand that in some jurisdictions you're supposed to consider everybody armed. All law-abiding citizens should be armed, as it is presumed in many of the constitutional carry states. Those are the states that have permitless carry. Essentially, civilians can carry concealed firearms as long as they're law-abiding citizens without any training. And many jurisdictions, I mentioned before, 33 states have some version of a stand your ground law. These are, you know, basically the idea is that civilians should take upon themselves their own security and safety. And certainly this is amplified when you have circumstances in which people feel themselves to be under threat, whether it's by terrorists or by this notion of criminality run rampant. And a lot of this happens in spite of documented declines in crime. So since the 1970s, we've seen a decline in crime, but also since the 1970s, we've seen a shift away from gun ownership for hunting and more towards gun ownership as self-protection.
In the castle that is supposedly protected by the man's gun or weapon, whatever, if a woman was in fear of her life for domestic violence reasons, there was, in fact, explicitly no right to do anything to protect herself.
Right. And this has been an ongoing problem, is that even in stand your ground states, many women who try to stand their ground against abusive intimate partners end up going to prison, even if they don't end up killing. I'm sure you're familiar with the Marissa Alexander case. She's a woman from Florida who was recently released from house arrest. She shot warning shots to protect herself from her abusive spouse. And she was imprisoned. She was found guilty of use of a deadly weapon. And essentially, she tried to claim self-defense, but the law and jury saw her as not being afraid or not being reasonably afraid of her abusive spouse. They saw her as angry. This has a lot to do with race as well as gender. As a black woman, the law tends to express its implicit biases against black women by characterizing them as unreasonable in claiming fear. And reasonable, the idea of reasonable in criminal law is really vital. And if the jury can't imagine you as being reasonably afraid, you're not going to get acquitted, understand your ground. And if you look at the cases, white property owning, typically men, end up doing pretty well. It, for instance, George Zimmerman claiming self-defense against an unarmed black teenager, Trayvon Martin. The stand your ground laws, I think, amplify pre-existing racial and gender kinds of inequalities in the way that the law gets adjudicated. A recent study came out showing that in Florida, since 2005, when that first stand your ground law was instantiated, homicides have increased by over 30%. Mm. So what does that mean? That means that I think stand your ground laws contribute to this frame of mind that you should shoot first and ask questions later.
Carolyn Light is director of undergraduate studies at the Harvard Program for Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Her new book is titled Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So interesting. But we started this hour talking about the election going on for the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. With the vote coming up this weekend, what do you want to see from a new DNC leader?
Hi, this is Tony from Upper Dublin, Pennsylvania. The new DNC chair should be a great visionary with a way to stay true to the party's values of diversity, inclusion, while being able to get the disenfranchised back to the fold, a fighter and a unifier.
Hi, this is Martha in Miami. I definitely want to see a very energetic, creative, inclusive new DNC chair person. I want to make sure that they include every race, every sex, every color, every gender, every religion, reaching to all 50 states, especially the working classes. I want the DNC to start up a massive voter registration campaign and keep it going.
Well, you can hope, Martha, or you can dream. Give us your take. Tell us your story at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, of course. Finish watching the rest of those Oscar movies for Sunday. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. Fox Searchlight, presenting A United Kingdom, the new romantic drama from the director of Belle and starring David Oyelowo and Rosamund Pike. Based on a true story, A United Kingdom is in select theaters now.
PRI, Public Radio International.